Hello and welcome to the Bylines Network podcast, an audio accompaniment to our growing family of regional Bylines publications.
Our focus this week is on Pride, where we're discussing the experiences of LGBT plus people at school, the commercialisation of Pride and the conversion therapy ban being brought in by the government.
We were also joined by a special guest, Lloyd Russell Moore, the MP for Brighton, Kemp Town and Peacehaven.
Your hosts this week are
Chris in Brighton
and Connor in Newcastle.
So first off, happy Pride. Happy Pride,
Connor. Happy Pride, Chris.
How are you spending Pride this year, or what we're allowed to do?
I'm spending my Pride by focusing on self-reflection, focusing on my spiritual and personal growth over the past few years as a queer person. And I'm also focusing on doing stuff for my charity, Schools Matter UK, as I want to improve the outcomes of the next generation of LGBT plus students, especially since from the research that I've done, they're less likely to achieve well at their GCSEs due to the isolation and discrimination that they face. So for me, my Pride has very much been focused on supporting the next generation.
That sounds fantastic. And tell us a bit more about the charity that you're working with.
Schools Matter UK is a charity that I started at the beginning of January. There's still a long way to go in terms of setting it up, but what I was wanting to do was train up GCSE tutors to tutor disadvantaged students for free. I also wanted to start a grant scheme for schools that may be struggling financially. Kind of interesting how I came up with that idea right before the government funding controversy happened. And my main focus at the moment is running awareness campaigns of issues going on within the education sector. And I think one of them in the near future could be the experiences with LGBT plus youth.
Well, I'll be spending my Pride probably either at home or on the beach at the moment. There was, unfortunately, the parade down here in Brighton is postponed at the moment, but we've been doing a lot at work promoting how to be good allies. That's been really important, and luckily the place I work is fantastic in promoting that, and everyone's really accepting and positive and progressive, and it's been fantastic to have really open conversations with people about what it means to be LGBT plus in the community and speak to, you know, straight people and non-queer people on the struggles that we've had to go through and things we experience. And it's been really good to sort of have people's eyes opened. That's one thing I don't know why I was shocked, but you know, people were surprised to hear kind of the experiences that we've had. I know that from what you said earlier, you know, I think things have changed a lot and remarkably in the last few years. I don't know if you agree with me. Just even throughout my lifetime, and I'm 22, the period since I left school to where I am now in 2021 in a full-time job. I don't know if you feel the same.
A lot has changed, but a lot hasn't. For example, what I'm hearing about your workplace sounds really amazing. Would you say that makes you feel a lot more safe when you go to work? Are you confident in the fact that you get on with your work, knowing that you're going to be safe and protected by not just your superiors?
Absolutely. I feel that, you know, a good network of colleagues around you, and I do have a fantastic network of colleagues. Everybody is so supportive. You know, our office in Brighton, I think, is majority LGBT, which is, I've never worked in a space like that before. It's very different to, you know, the spaces I grew up in, the school I went to. You know, I went to school in Enfield in North London. It was a comprehensive school. I knew I was not straight from quite a young age. But being in that kind of environment, it wasn't, I didn't feel it was okay to be out, if you know what I mean. It didn't feel like a particularly accepting environment. I remember sort of people running around the playground at the time going, that's so gay,
gay. Oh, yeah.
And more stuff than that, that's sort of, that was one of the small things which I can remember. But I mean, even looking now, my sister goes to the same school. You know, she said to me that she's got several friends who are members of the LGBT community, and they're fully out while they're at school. They came out a few years ago. You know, there are people at the school who identify as non-binary, as transgender, and everybody is accepting. And it's the same school. And I only left there maybe, 5-6 years ago? And it's astounding to see the progress that's been made. Obviously, there's still a lot more to do.
A lot.
But it's incredible to see that kind of progress been made already.
I think it's a similar thing at my school. I'm not going to name this, as I have so much respect and admiration for my teachers, for my support workers, since I'm also an autistic queer. So that's definitely added another layer of intersectionality to my experiences, since a lot of the ableism that I don't think is talked about often enough is the assumption that you can't have a sexuality. That's very much the assumption that people make, which is so damaging. Two of the people who I was friends with at school actually were also autistic and queer. So it was so amazing to sort of have that community.
Mm.
And a couple of other people in my year did like come out as queer in one way or another. And it was quite amazing to see that transition happen. However, even during that time, there was still a lot of homophobic and queerphobic slurs going around. For example, "Oh, that's so gay." A couple of the horse slurs that I think you know, but I'm not going to say it on air because I don't want to trigger anyone. But they were literally from, you know, the stereotypical people, you know, the athletes, the people who like loved playing their sport.
Yeah.
Who felt the need to maintain this hierarchy. And for me, PE was a living hell in that sense. Because I was in an ORC, which is a specialised provision for those with autism, I was able to get changed in the department, obviously with the other people from that department who I was really close friends with. Even then, I would insist on getting changed in the disabled toilet. Since I absolutely like hated PE, I hated the very concept of it. I felt very alone and isolated. The amount of homophobia that would go on there was absolutely awful. Like, I hated my body as well. I still have body image issues, so I didn't want people to see me like that, if you know what I mean. Don't get me wrong, I was blessed with the best teachers. So the second that they sensed that something was up, the second that they and my mom sensed that I was really struggling, I got pulled out of PE straight away. I was only one of two people in my year who were able to not do PE. So I was very blessed in that sense.
And I don't think we can thank the supportive people in our lives from that period where we weren't even comfortable in ourselves. You know, I'm very lucky in that my family have been fantastic with me coming out. I can't thank them enough for, you know, the support they've given me over the last few years. And, you know, they did know before I came out to them. They didn't say anything. They left it for me to decide and to say and tell them. I luckily had that experience, you know. I had the time and the space to think and do it myself, and you know, that's something taken away from quite a lot of people. So I'm incredibly lucky in that respect.
Oh, that's so amazing. So do you feel like you're able to have those open conversations about, say, relationships you might be in or anything that you're struggling with? For example, if you were to experience a hate crime, do you feel confident knowing that if you're able to turn to your family, do you feel confident in the fact that they would support you and defend you 100%?
Yeah, I do. I've always gone to, especially my mum, I've always gone to my mum with things like that. And you know, I've always been able to be open and honest with her about my experiences. And again, you know, anything that's happened, she's, and even, you know, since I was very, very young, she'd say, just be yourself. It doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter who you love. Doesn't matter who you end up being with. You know, I'm still your mother. I'll always love you still. I think the one thing that she emphasized on me and my sisters was that if we voted Tory, she'd never talk to us again. but you know, the coming out as gay was absolutely fine. Good thing I don't vote Tory.
It's fine to be gay as long as you don't vote for the Conservatives.
That was her outlook, yeah.
I love that. I stand that.
yeah. So now we're going to move on to our chat that we had with the Kemp Town and Peacehaven MP, Lloyd Russell-Moyle.
With him, we discussed what Pride means to him, how the commercialization of Pride has happened over the years. He gives us his take on the government's plan to ban conversion therapy. And lastly, we discuss if he feels optimistic about the future for the LGBT community in the UK.
So for this week's Pride-themed episode, we're joined by Lloyd Russell-Moyle, who's the MP for Kemp Town and Peacehaven, near Brighton, in Brighton-ish. I've recently moved, so I'm not too sure the areas too much. But
I cover what some people would call as the gay village of Brighton. So I cover everything that includes where all the gay bars are and the nightclubs for the community. Although that's not where it always was. It originally was more in the centre of Brighton, but in the last 50 years, it's moved over to east of the pier.
Arguably hosting one of the best Pride events in the country, I think. Bit controversial, but
well, the Pride in the park, that's in, not in my constituency, that's Caroline's constituency, but I host the party on the street. Mm. The street party is in my patch, and that's been going on now for a number of years.
I went to the last Pride in Brighton was 2019. Obviously there wasn't one in 2020 in person anyway. It was Kylie was performing in Preston Park, and I have to say, I think that was one of the best days of my life ever. I hadn't had a bigger smile on my face since.
I much preferred Kylie than Britney, personally, who had been the year before. Maybe that's just something about kind of my age, and I felt like I knew Kylie's songs better than I knew Britney's stuff, where she was miming half of it and everything. But you know,
it's Britney all the way. I'm sorry, like, I grew up listening to her music. I idolized her. I wanted to be her so much growing up. That was the one music artist that I would always like blast in my mom's car.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't get sick of it. Although she did get sick of the Christmas song that she did that I would always make up on repeat. So, Kylie's good, but it's Britney. Sorry.
You're a Britney. Well, look, we've had both in Brighton, so we don't discriminate.
We've already got that controversial topic out of the way, Kylie or Britney.
Well, I mean, there is a link there, isn't there, to what does Pride mean and the commercialisation question about Pride, because the two go hand in hand. You can't claim that Pride is just a political protest.
Mm.
Which it is partly, but you can't say it's only a political process. And then we've enjoyed having a conversation about the fun acts that we've seen and that we've had there, because that is part of the other side of the coin of Pride, which is a celebration. And it is a celebration where everyone joins in, even kind of, you know, bands and events. And to some extent, both Kylie and Britney, they didn't play just out of the goodness of their heart. They played and launched their UK tours in Brighton, at Brighton Pride, but they did it as part of a commercial package that they were selling across the UK, their tour.
Mm. And I mean, that kind of nicely segues into sort of one of the questions that we've discussed before between me and Connor. But we, you know, Pride means something different to everybody. Like you said, a lot of people see it as a protest. Quite a lot of people see it as a celebration. What does Pride mean to you, though? Where do you sort of stand it? From what you said, it's kind of a bit of both, celebration and a protest.
of course, it's both. I mean, all good protests should be a little bit about a celebration, you know, kind of celebrating what you want to have, what you don't want to have, in that kind of stuff. And they should be fun. But for LGBT people or LGBT plus queer people, there has always been an element of the protest is about protesting against invisibility, protesting against repression. And one of the ways, best ways of protesting that has always been about visibility. And if you go back to the kind of gay liberation front here in the UK, before most prides really were regular, they were doing protests already. If you think about when Mary Whitehouse organised her Festival of Light, which was a kind of Christian festival of purity and goodness and against, you know, kind of sexual deviance. And they all dressed up in kind of nuns' habits, snuck in, and then halfway through the conference, stripped off and started snogging each other, these women snogging each other in front of these prudes. And so that is a protest, but it's also about visibility. It's also about showing we are here. And of course, marching through the streets as a protest has a softer element. I mean, you're not going into someone else's space. You're not going into someone else's conference and doing that, but you're doing it in a, of course, political manner. But that doesn't always have to mean that that it is kind of an aggressive political act or even kind of an overtly political act. Just the process of being, when you're being denied your being, the process of being is political. And I think that part of Pride should be far more political. We should encourage more political kind of thinking in it. But at the same time, we shouldn't exclude people who have a much more narrow political vision, interest, and see the fun part of taking part in it. I mean, I take part in other celebrations, you know, kind of whether it's the Durham Miners Gala, you know, kind of celebrating, you know, kind of working class history, or whether it's bonfire night in my hometown is Lewes down the road, where we kind of take bonfire night rather too seriously and still march through the streets with dressed up and build giant tableaus of political figures and blow them up, and you know, kind of do. And that's political, but it's also fun. The same with the Durham Miners Gala. It is political, but it is fun. And I think people who want to divorce the two are on a hiding to nothing. Now, does that mean that this year probably provides an interesting opportunity, because most of the fun elements of the prides, the parties in the park in Brighton or in London, those official parades where you have floats and it's more of a carnival, that's been cancelled, quite understandably. But political protests are still allowed to happen. So will there be a purely political element in those prides? Will people step up? Or actually, does it ruin the whole concept and people won't step up and there won't be a political element of pride at all? This is the tester. So all those people who have said it's too much fun and not enough politics, it's too much, you know, kind of frivolity, then let's see what happens.
And I think from experience, Brighton Pride is sort of managed between the two very, very well. You know, I remember the 2019 and the year before, and even the online pride this year, they had, you know, conversations with political figures like yourself and I think the local MPs and lots of other organizations. So I think that balance can be struck.
Well, Brighton Pride is unlike some organization, Brighton Pride is a non-profit, so it does make money. The point of making the money is to pay for the LGBT safety forum, the LGBT mental health charity, you know, kind of Lunch Positive gets money, which is the HIV Positive Lunch Club on Fridays. Those organisations receive money from Pride to keep their work going. So it has a community element to it, but also the organisers have always tried to have an element of politics in it, you know, kind of, because Pride in Brighton and Pride in most places in Britain really got big after Section 28. So, of course, London Pride is a bit older because it was about showing solidarity with Stonewall. Most of the other prides, really, they got organised and regular after Section 28 was being introduced. And so that does mean that a lot of them have that kind of background. They have a political background, but they didn't start from a riot, which is what Stonewall started from. They started from a kind of domestic discussion that we were having.
We've seen so much commercialization of Pride over the past few years. Funny thing, I went to my local shopping centre the other week because I just love shopping. I'm a bit stereotypical like that. There were literally Pride photos all over the shop windows. The August one in particular kind of struck me because it was simply something like We Support Pride 2021 or something like that. No charity logos, no suggestions that they were donating any of their profits for the month to charity. And that was seen across the entire shopping centre. Do you think that big corporations making a big spectacle of supporting Pride Month are actually being genuinely supportive of the movement, or is it more performative in nature and more as a way of gaining more capital and more profit?
Well, I think there is an element of offensiveness if people are just doing it and they will make more money out of it. You know, if you can brand a put a flag on it, it means you're going to make more money. I think it's fine for businesses to show support, you know, kind of to, but I think it should be one of two things. It either should be focused on the staff networks of that organisation. So people who work in Argos or people who work in the police who are saying, well, we are LGBT and we want to show support for this, and their allies in the shop who want to do the same. Or it could well be promotions that the shop do, but you're right, it should then be linked to Pride. I mean, I know, you know, on St. James's Street, Sainsbury's at the end probably make a huge load of money during Pride weekend. Pride in Brighton, of course, is in August. But in Pride weekend, and they put their big flags out and they put signs just like you said. And they have the party right on their doorstep. So everyone's going in and buying a sandwich or drinks or nibbles and things like that from them. But they give nothing. That store gives nothing whatsoever to any of the charities. The bars all of that up that street, every single bar up that street will have given money to the Pride organisation to help support and their LGBT focused bars. You know, the other shops down that street might have well done that as well. But Sainsbury's, a big corporate, won't. But they've got a huge sign outside that says, we support Pride. And anyone that comes to the city will think, oh, well, I want to support maybe this issue. And they'll not be able to determine the difference. So I think there's nothing wrong with business showing support. But it either must be linked to them actual showing support, or it must be linked to a network. And that in Brighton Pride, two things have happened. One is, to take part in with a float, you now have to demonstrate that the business is doing above and beyond. So you can't just, you know, one year we had Tesco and Smirnoff putting rainbow flags on their vodka bottles, I think it was. that they're not allowed to take part unless they prove it's from one of those two things. And the other thing that we've done, and they've done, is they've launched a kind of Pride Friends thing. So it's a badge that you can put on businesses that you know that they're actually properly contributing, because you're right, I think it is a problem.
I mean, you've got quite a lot of good examples. I mean, the first one that sort of comes to mind, I think, is the Co-op. You know, I think they donate to charity, all kinds of charities, I mean, 365 days of the year. From what I've read and what I've looked at with the work they do, and they work with LGBT charities throughout the year as well. I mean, it is possible. Companies do it. It should be definitely encouraged more.
I don't necessarily need to see virtue signalling from businesses unless they actually mean it. Mm. I don't need to see businesses put up a red poppy during remembrance services unless they actually are contributing to our service personnel, or they are contributing to fundraising for that, or maybe, you know, kind of their employees are particularly wanting to wear those things. I think corporate badging generally for good causes must be about them contributing to those causes and not just about them making themselves look good. So it's not just a Pride thing. It covers lots of areas, doesn't it? You know, kind of businesses trying to make a fast one on lots of issues. But Pride, I think, is the most obvious.
Yeah. So sort of moving on a little bit to the government sort of legislating to ban conversion therapy. Now, we all know they've been saying that for quite a long time. And with, I think they've recently announced a public consultation. And there has been some criticism on it, though, with that consultation possibly lengthening the process or the length of time before a ban actually is brought in. There's also been some criticism that religious bodies could be exempt from this. So what could the opposition and the government be doing or do differently to ensure that a comprehensive ban is brought in as soon as possible and that it is comprehensive and there are no exemptions to ban this practice?
Well, there will need to be some exemptions because they will need to ensure that this doesn't prevent people having therapy and counselling on when they are trying to transition. So we're not trying to convert people. Therapy shouldn't have a process of having an aim, but it might well be you need therapy for to transition between genders. And in Canada, where they introduced a ban, there was an attempt to include trans people in that ban as well. And so it would have prevented trans people from receiving transition support. So it is a complex thing. So it's not just about saying we would ban any discussion of sexuality in therapy. Because also many LGBT people themselves want to sometimes see what we need to do is stop it. If therapy has any intention of pushing someone into something, that's the focus. And there needs to be no exceptions for religious basis or belief basis. The exceptions must only ever be about what's right for the individual who's in the therapy. Will the government come forward with it? Well, we will see. I would say that this government has handled consultations very badly so far on LGBT and other sensitive issues. And if we look at how they've dealt with the trans issue, and I don't like calling it self-ID because that's never been the proposal. Not many people support self-ID. What there was talk about was changing the way the Gender Recognition Act worked so that it was more appropriate to the needs of trans people and reflected the changing international law that doesn't allow doctors to prescribe gender dysphoria as a disease anymore. And the law only allowed you to transition because of gender dysphoria. Does that make sense? So the international say that you shouldn't use that anymore, but our law says that's the only way to transition. So we had to have a consultation to change it. But rather than the government coming forward to put forward a plan, this is how we want to, this is the proposals from the international level, this is the proposals from the research that we've done. What do you think about doing X, Y, and Z? What they did is they just opened an open-end conversation saying, what do you think about gender recognition, self-ID, people being able to change their gender at will? Well, that was never really what was being discussed. What was being discussed is moving it from a medical process to a social process. You know, it doesn't matter what your medical diagnosis is. What do you live as? Who are you? And actually most people on all sides would say we want the law to recognise who you are, what you are seen as and what you are in the community and what you are in yourself, not about what a mental health diagnosis is. It wasn't even about a diagnosis of your bits and bobs, if you understand what I mean. It was about a mental health diagnosis. That's all it was in the current law. That would be very sensible. But instead, they had this open-ended thing, no guiding, really, things, and it opened up a huge can of worms that we're now suffering from. And it's a uniquely British problem that hasn't really spread elsewhere because the government managed to mess it up. So there's a problem with them then doing an open-ended conversation about conversion therapy as well, because I would worry actually the same thing will happen. What needs to happen is the government needs to come forward with a green paper. This is how consultations normally happen on laws. We need to stop this faux rubbish consultation that the Conservatives like so much. Normally what happens is the government brings forward a white paper. A white paper outlines where's the government's thinking. Then there is a consultation on that white paper where people have something concretely to feed into. When that white paper consultation is finished, they publish a green paper, which is the paper of the proposed law that they're going to lay down in Parliament. And then that green paper goes into Parliament. That is what should happen again. That's what used to always happen. And that would be, I think, a acceptable way forward, not this kind of random consultation that we might or might not take the findings from if we like.
I mean, it's quite a complicated issue as well, as you've outlined. There are quite a lot of different layers to that. Like you mentioned Canada. That was something I wasn't aware of. I had no idea that that was involved in the ban that they brought in.
Well, it was not, but there was an attempt to from some right-wing groups who are anti-trans to do that. And they managed to not get that. They stopped that bit in Parliament. But you understand what I mean? There will be attempts to shove loads of things into this bill that might actually be, on the surface, seem really good. But we've got to make sure the detail is right.
So far this Pride month, we've seen the government equalities officers try to pull the UK from the Stonewall Diversity Programme, which I personally find to oddly link to last year's government defunding the anti-homophobic bullying programmes that the government funded. And we've also seen the government at large discussing the decreasing the amount of foreign aid given to other countries. Do you feel optimistic for the future of LGBTQ acceptance in the UK? And I know that you find the HIV and AIDS treatment and prevention particularly important. So do you also think that the decrease in foreign aid will slow down that process worldwide?
Let's do this backwards. The decrease in foreign aid will immediately mean that more people die. For young people, HIV and AIDS is still one of the biggest killers in the world. And we know exactly that thousands of people are saved every year through medical interventions by British Aid. We'll reduce it by 80%. That means hundreds of thousands of people will, unless another country comes forward, they will not get the treatment they need. And they might well, most probably will die. I mean, it sounds very drastic, doesn't it? That's why I'm kind of pausing to say it, because I don't like going to say about that. So I'm very worried about that. And I think that is a deeply wrong decision. And so do a lot of Conservatives, actually, enough to probably cause the government to lose a vote in Parliament if they bother to bring it forward. The government are refusing to allow us to have a vote on it. I think more broadly, what we have seen is the government have their priorities. And the government's priorities are not things like rounded education, are not things like supporting minority groups in terms of funding. They have a different view of where things should be funded. And that means that some of the programmes that are very important have been got rid of or have been defunded. I think on Stonewall, it's not actually a funding issue. On Stonewall is caught up in this trans issue. Stonewall has been very strong and very clear that they believe that the Gender Recognition Act needs to be transformed. And it needs to be based on social prescribing and social acceptance and how people are living their lives, and not based on a mental health diagnosis that might not reflect actually how someone is living their life. But there has been a vociferous campaign against that. Now, there's lots of fears that are justified. People can have very justifiable and understandable fears on lots of different things, particularly if you have fought for your rights in other areas. But sometimes with fears, even if they are legitimately felt, you need to be told it is not a legitimate feeling to portray that on a whole nother group. You know, if I am attacked by a certain group of people, either a racial minority or a gender minority or whatever, I can't then portray that to say I have a dislike for the rights of that group of people. Does that make sense? So we can't be saying, because of some awful experiences, that should inform the debate of people's rights. And Stonewall have been very clear about that. And Stonewall have advocated very strongly. And also, of course, there is a nature of British law. British law develops. British law develops through common law and through practice. And so where we have a greater understanding of what equality means, the equality law, of course, can be have a wider scope. And some people are now trying to limit that scope, really bring it back down to a very essentialist view of what is sex and what is gender. And that is, Stonewall has been caught up in that. But Stonewall's not the only one. If you remember the National Audit, the National Statistics Office was taken to court over this. And it's a totally bizarre situation where you're taken to court over this. 10 years ago, the census said, please put your sex in this box. And the appropriate note was, if you are a trans person or you are questioning your sex, please put in whichever sex you feel best describes the gender that you live by. Effectively, it was self-ID 10 years ago. The census this year actually said, please put in the sex of which it says on a government document. So actually, it wasn't self-ID this time. So it said passport, driving license, birth certificate or gender recognition certificate. They were taken to court by the anti-trans lobby. That's what they are, an anti-trans lobby, to not allow them to have people putting what is in their driving license or passport. People are only allowed to put on their birth certificate or their gender recognition act because there's a slightly different process of changing. So already the National Statistics Office had already reduced actually self-ID, and that was not good enough for the haters. And I'm afraid they are haters and they're unpleasant and they might have real legitimate reasons for having that fear and hate. Fear and hate are two sides of the same coin, you know. And sometimes it can be unintentional hate, and sometimes it because it's from fear, but that's what it manifests itself as, I'm afraid. And the only way that we can deal with that is through standing strong with Stonewall and education. At the same time, we need to be a bit clever. We need to be clever to constantly talk about this debate in terms of technicalities. The technical situation is the World Health Organization says that we can't be issuing these gender dysphoria diagnoses anymore. We have to find a new way of allowing people to change their sex and gender. Of course, we have to have a process for that. The process most acceptable for almost everyone is a process that's based on socialization, based on a social diagnosis. And that, I think, is where we win it. And we then need to, at the same time, also be a bit clever with Stonewall. Stonewall requires a fee to take part in these programs. It might well be clever for Stonewall to say, well, we'll waive this fee for public bodies. And then what's the excuse? Because a lot of these public bodies from the government are hiding behind that they have budget savings. They can't afford £6,000 or whatever it is to enter the equality program. Okay, well, we'll waive it for you. And then if they say that they refuse to do it, then it's easier for us to tackle the actual issue.
Yeah, definitely.
And sort of with sort of touching on what you were talking about earlier, you know, with the current government, it just can LGBT people, do you feel, can they feel confident and can they feel optimistic about the future of, you know, the LGBT community in this country? Can they feel confident about their acceptance? Because I think at the end of the day, and this is just my opinion, I think a lot of that, it doesn't come down to government. It comes down to us. It comes down to what we do. It comes down to what we say, and it comes down to our actions.
Yes and no. In the sense of, I think that most Britons are supportive of the LGBT community. Most Britons are supportive of trans people. They just want people to be able to get on with their lives and enjoy themselves. And most people don't really want people to be upset or miserable or have discrimination. They don't see these as issues. They just, you know, they see these as two consenting people, or consenting people can do what they want with love. I think that's the fast, and that's pretty embedded in the public's mind. However, let's not be confused that things can roll back. Before Section 28, the reason Section 28 was introduced by the Conservative government at the time, which banned the promotion of homosexuality in public service, was because the London local authority introduced a book which was about two dads looking after a daughter. It was a completely innocuous, very boring book. I mean, send you to sleep boring, you know, kind of. Jenny goes with Martin to have an ice cream. Jenny goes with Martin to the zoo. Jenny go, you know, kind of, it was a picture book kind of thing. And that caused so much outrage that that actually did set us back. And that's not the problem with people who put the book in. But what I'm saying is that then for 20 odd years, that would have been illegal to even have had that book in the school. You have to wait 20 plus years to change that law. So things can go backwards. Don't get me wrong. Things can get worse. But I think in the public's mind, things are pretty good. I think, however, it's the framework in which the public have to legally operate that could get much worse.
And so thanks, Lloyd, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you. And I hope you have a fantastic Pride Month.
Noel, I hope that we all have a good Pride Month. Thank you very much to Connor and to you.
Thank you for having us. It's been lovely meeting you.
It's been good meeting you too. Cheers.
So thanks so much to Lloyd for joining us for this episode. It's fascinating conversations that we've had. I hope that everyone has learned a lot from those discussions. I certainly have.
Follow us on @bylinespod on social media. We want to thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you have a fantastic rest of Pride Month. I know I'll be listening to Britney non-stop.
And music was Voxel Revolution by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks, Kevin.